Looking back on past events helps to explain why we look and think the way we do. The makeup and reputation of our towns, universities and neighborhoods, and attitudes toward ethnic groups are based on history. What are some particular events that shape the land and the people of Dane County today? Welcome to Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Cole Hornaday. Mind's Eye Radio is a program tuned to the sounds of social change. It's written and produced by The Writer's Place and Mind's Eye Audio Productions. Today, 10 local writers will step back in time to the events that shape the Dane County of today. We'll even peer into the future with predictions for the next millennium. But first, the legend of the lost city in the UW Arboretum, and the construction and deconstruction and reconstruction of the state capitol, and a landscape interpretation of the Wisconsin Glacier. Stay tuned. Dane County sits on a geological borderline. In the last ice age, about 15,000 years ago, the Wisconsin Glacier splayed its massive fingers over eastern Dane County, but managed to spare the western part of the county its full force. The lay of the land in eastern Dane County is dotted with the telltale signs the glacier left behind. Writer Laura Polin walked the edge of the glacier with naturalist Gary Werner. Werner heads the Dane County chapter of the Ice Age Park and Trail Foundation. He interpreted the landscape at Tower Park on County Road PB near Verona.
Here at the Dane County Parkland down southeast of Verona, we are standing on the edge, the leading edge of the terminal moraine left by the Wisconsin Glacier about 15,000 years ago. We're at a place where we can look and see some of the bedrock called St. Peter Sandstone, deposited in a sea about 450 or 500 million years ago, and rising above it to the horizon to the north are a series of ridges of the moraine formed by sand and gravel, cobbles, pieces of granite and basalt, and other erratics, interlopers, rocks that aren't native to the area, picked up by the glacier in northern Wisconsin or the Upper Peninsula of Michigan or even in Canada, and dragged and hauled and scraped and broken up all this way to be dropped on the Wisconsin landscape 15,000 years ago.
When the ice melts and the land is finally freed from the relentless grip of the glacier, left behind is the accumulated debris that the glacier transported. This forms the long, narrow ridges that are called moraines. The Ice Age Trail follows the course of the moraine as it wends its way across Wisconsin. Erratics are boulders that were carried great distances on these glacial conveyor belts and can be as big as a bus or even a house. You can see some in Devil's Lake State Park. Drumlins are small, teardrop-shaped hills. They're molded as the ice advances and retreats perhaps many times over the same territory, and all the drumlins left by a particular glacier face the same direction. In Wisconsin, drumlins are found by the thousands, and some people have likened them to seeing the backs of a group of whales from up above. The Wisconsin State Capitol sits on top of one of these hills, and a glacial drumlin forms the backbone of the Edna Taylor Conservation Park on Femright Drive.
Yeah, one of the interesting contrasts here in Dane County, landscape contrasts, and part of what makes Dane County such an enjoyable, interesting place to live, is this rather dramatic contrast between the well-drained, steep, angular topography of the unglaciated or driftless area in the southwestern third of the county, and the eastern two-thirds of the county, that the glaciated portion, which is really a very poorly drained landscape, a landscape that in many ways, like a sponge, is still drying out from the melting of the glaciers 15,000 years ago. The combination of the material that was brought by the glaciers, hundreds and hundreds of millions of tons of debris, and then dropped these kinds of materials have created a whole series of dams across the preglacial watersheds, and the ice, in fact, itself, in grinding and creaking across Dane County, plucked material out of several of the basins, out of the bedrock, to form the lake basins that Madison is built around, the Lakes Mendota and Monona in particular. And the combination of the basins created by the glacial sculpting and the debris forming dams have enabled the other lakes, the Wabisa, Kiganza, and the other lakes of eastern Dane County, as well as large, large areas of marshland, bogs, other wetlands to pool as the glaciers melted. Initially, Lake Mendota and Monona, in fact, a much larger lake that covered most of eastern Dane County and over into Jefferson and down into Rock County as the glaciers melted, were, you know, the direct result of the meltwaters of the glacier. From where we're standing now on top of the moraine, the terminal moraine, the moraine is called the Johnstown Moraine by the geologists. It's because of the little community called Johnstown Center in Rock County, and it marks the place where the glacier stopped about 15,000 years ago. This was a sheet of ice that started forming in the area of Hudson's Bay in the Canadian Arctic, about 800 miles to the northeast of us.
Glaciers begin where snow doesn't melt. Given enough time, the fallen snow becomes compressed into a large, thick ice sheet. At about 100 feet in depth, the ice sheet's own weight bearing down causes it to move and flow, much like a slow river.
Much like when you pour pancake batter on a griddle, it'll flow outward in all directions. So it's not that the ice is flowing downhill or anything per se, but it's just the sheer weight and mass of the ice sheet itself. This ice sheet, the ice creaked and groaned across the landscape, well, for thousands of years, essentially, and finally came to a halt here in Dane County near Verona, basically taking anything that was sharp and angular and pretty much making it rounded and curved. And then the point at which the ice, the flow of the ice going forward, was matched by the warmth of the sun melting, is essentially formed the stopping point, the leading edge of the glacier. That's where we're standing right here. It wasn't that the glacier, you know, like you stop a car. It wasn't like you just came down here and, you know, put on the brakes and said, let's stop at this point. Glaciers don't work that way. It's just that right here, where we're standing, it was melting faster or as fast as it was moving forward. So the net effect of that is those two forces or actions is that the glacier at this point becomes a monumental conveyor belt that's bringing hundreds and millions of tons of debris right down here and dumping it right here. And that's the drama on life on the edge of the glacier.
The glaciers also left not only rocks and debris behind, but soil so rich with minerals, it became the basis for the fertile agricultural farmland of the Midwest. Moraines, being rocky and steep, were often not farmed, and for this reason still harbor today that most rarest of flora, the remains of our native plant communities.
And one of the benefits of the effort underway by a number of people and organizations to try to preserve some of these glacial landforms as part of the Ice Age National Scenic Trail is not only to preserve the scenic quality of the landscape, the actual evidence of the glacier's handiwork, but also preserve some of the intact native plant animal communities that help make Wisconsin such a beautiful and diverse place to live.
When done, the Ice Age Trail will be a continuous footpath, 1,000 miles long, that shadows the path of the moraines left by the most recent glacier's advance. As of today, 500 miles of trail are completed and open for public use and enjoyment. This is Laura Polin with Gary Werner Ice Age Trail Interpreter Extraordinaire in Verona, Wisconsin, where the glaciers ended.
Wisconsin's 150-year anniversary, or sesquicentennial, is a rich opportunity to celebrate our state's colorful history. But in our flush of pride, we must remember that this land was not always ours. This was the land of the Ho-Chunk Indians and several other Native American tribes. It was only through the forced and often cruel removal of Indians that Wisconsin became a state and Madison the capital. At the Ho-Chunk Language and Culture Center in Mauston, Wisconsin, tribal members are dedicated to remembering the past and preserving the culture. Guy Thorvaldsen spoke with both Randy Telmage and Ken Funmaker at the center to learn more about the six times the Ho-Chunks were moved off their lands in the 1800s.
My name is Ken Funmaker, Sr., and my Ho-Chunk name is Hwamaniga, which is a Bear Clan name. It means snowwalker.
As an elder of the tribe, Ken has a formidable presence, a broad-shouldered former steel worker who challenges you with clear thinking and strong beliefs. He created a picture of the Ho-Chunk people in the early 1800s, describing to me the lives of the people who were forced to relocate. As I listened, I heard the story of a highly developed people who lived by the four seasons, by ritual and ceremony, by the teachings of the earth, as well as the movements of the heavens.
Our people, the original name was called Ho-Chunk, which is means the parent tongue or the sacred language. Everything that the Creator thought that we should have as far as food and plants, you know, for medicines and so forth, everything was here for us. So we were leading a pretty peaceful life. When these villages were established, there were there's 12 clans within our tribe, 6 upper and 6 lower. Within these 12 different clans, they all had jobs, and that's how these villages operated. And it wasn't a slipshod operation. It was highly sophisticated. The learning system, how they taught other people, was up to the elders, the grandparents, the great-grandparents, and then they lived in chipotles or wigwams. Some of them were single-family units. Some of them were 2 fireplaces, 3 fireplaces. Then they had different kinds of games that were played that were, you know, during the seasons, different kinds of games for men and women. So, like today, they're talking about gaming, you know, something that it's new. It's not new. It's something that we did, you know. I think everybody done that, you know. It was just a way of life with everybody. You had to, you know, take a chance on something.
In the early 1800s, when the United States saw fit to exercise its self-proclaimed right of eminent domain, they chose to remove by treaty and force not savages, but a highly developed people. Randy Talmadge, Funmaker's nephew, relates the final chain of events of that time that led to their removal.
I think one would first have to look at the first treaty, which was signed by the Ho-Chunk people back in the year 1816. Now, this first treaty was called the Treaty of Peace and Friendship with the United States government. It was not long after this the door was opened and many of the invaders started to come in. It's been recorded historically, and especially with Ho-Chunk people orally, that thousands of miners from the east came into our home. At this time, during 1827, 1828, many of our people feeling this invasion, there was a man by the name of Redbird who was asked to lead a war party against the invaders. He didn't really want to do this, but eventually he did. And he attacked a French family just outside of Prairie du Chien. There was killing and injury and retaliation, of course, by the U.S. government. This action by Redbird and the U.S. government led to the Treaty of 1829. A little leverage there, a little bargaining by the government. All right, Redbird, we'll let you live, providing your people sign this Treaty of 1829. What did it mean? It meant that it ceded half the land of the Ho-Chunk territory. In this instance, if one would look at the map of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin River being the line, everything south of that was then ceded to the U.S. government in 1829. This was a lever by the U.S. government to allow Red Bird to live. Otherwise, he was to be hung. But a sad time for Ho-Chunk people because, yes, Red Bird was jailed at this time. But the Treaty of 1829 ceded pretty much the lands. And Madison, Dane County, Dajolp, the Four Lakes area, was right on that line. It wasn't until the next big session of 1832 where lands ceded, including the Green Bay area south, including Portage, Wisconsin, and Madison, ceding those lands to the U.S. government. From there came the first of the removals. This was a crucial time with Ho-Chunk people because now we were being condensed and moved to the west as we lost our good hunting lands, our good farmlands, the places where we would come together as one for the ceremonies, as my uncle discussed and described. The Treaty of 1837 took the last of our lands. The Treaty of 1837, where a delegation actually went to Washington, D.C. to meet with Great White Father. But what had happened at this time, as the agent indirectly was told to pull a fast one on these Ho-Chunk people, and a fast one he did. We signed a treaty where we agreed, yes, we will move from our home of Wisconsin. We thought we had 8 years to move, and through an action of deceit, we were actually given 8 months to move. By 1838, all Ho-Chunk people were to be removed and placed in what was called the neutral ground, the neutral ground being described as northeastern Iowa.
Following 1837, the Ho-Chunk were relocated 5 more times, each time forced to cede yet more land. They finally ended up in Crow Creek, South Dakota. Crow Creek, as Chief Baptiste of the Ho-Chunk described it, was damn cold country, no wood, bad country for Indians. Gradually, the Ho-Chunk gravitated back to their homeland in Wisconsin, and in 1963, they received recognition as a federally organized establishment, a move which has led to the formation of a growing Ho-Chunk economy and culture. The Language and Culture Center is part of that growth. The idea is to create a school of complete cultural immersion for the Ho-Chunk people. Today, scattered across 14 counties in Wisconsin and on a reservation in Nebraska, there are about 8,000 to 9,000 members of the Ho-Chunk Nation.
We got some decent-looking cars for the first time. And then, you know, we got some, you know, decent-looking houses and all. And so it kind of looking good, you know, that way, you know. But we're losing the language, though. So that's the reason for this program here.
Finally, I ask how the Ho-Chunk people, faced with such devastating historical events, maintain their will to carry on. Ken explained that the Ho-Chunk, through a mix of humility and stubbornness, were strong survivors.
So those 6 removals that we, you know, we talked about, you know, that we made it through those, you know, we can't let our people forget what happened because, you know, it's part of history.
Ken Funmaker and his nephew, Randy Talmadge, work at the Ho-Chunk Language and Culture Center in Mauston, Wisconsin. Guy Thorvaldsen spoke with them there.
In February 1904, people throughout Dane County merged on Madison to view the Capitol burning. As the day progressed and the fire waned, the crowd moved to attend a big ski tournament being pulled off on University Hill.
Sitting on a drumlin carved by the glacier and free of Native American occupation, the state of Wisconsin needed to designate a site for the state capitol. In 1836, it was decided that Madison would be that location, but not without a good fight. Karen Schultz recounts the gossip and events which led to the state capitol building as we know it today.
The story of this great building really started in November of 1836. I can still hear the men's voices, some shouting above others, and some whispering secret deals.
Very good.
The territorial capital was a very important matter. One could only imagine the amount of money that would be siphoned into such a location. One powerful voice in particular I remember well, the voice of Madison promoter James Duane Doty. He had such a manner to convince the legislators to choose Madison above 17 other locations for the capital. I can't imagine what the other people were thinking on the west side of the Mississippi, who had the majority population. Madison won, and although Doty's enemies swear it was due to his sale of corner lots to prominent voting men, the deal was still done.
Very good.
1837, the construction began, and in 1838, the first legislative session was held, not in the Capitol building, but in the American Hotel. It wasn't until 1844 that the Capitol was finished, and boy, did this bother the legislators. Hotels were pretty shabby in Madison. My friend, Rosalind Peck, from Green Bay, was even criticized by the hotsy-totsy representative folk from Milwaukee for her coffee in her popular Madison Inn. She never could get over that. I remember well the poem she wrote. Ho, Madison and its once-starved and angry crew with stomachs expanded so wide, who now in their pride can gulp down their stew and oysters and turkey beside. They should look back a few years and remember their mother who perspired to give them relief and have charity more for sister and brother whilst gorging their pie, cakes, and beef. Speaking of poor accommodations, it wasn't until 1846 that the hog house in the basement of the Capitol was moved. I'll reserve my comments here. 1848 was truly the grandest year for the Capitol. Wisconsin became a state, getting rid of all the excess land we now call Minnesota, Iowa, and the eastern parts of the Dakotas. Madison was now the state capital. Oh, yes, every year someone tried to change this fact, especially those rich merchants in Milwaukee, but somehow Madison held on. The Capitol building, however, wasn't big enough to satisfy the growing needs of the state government, and in 1857, it was agreed to add room to the building. What a fiasco. A year later, the city of Madison was down and out bankrupt. It didn't matter that a year before, the city property owners said they would foot the bill for the greater part of the construction. That bill went from $100,000 to $400,000. I won't even tell you what the Milwaukee politicians did, because they tried it again in 1871, saying that Madison still lacked the fine accommodations they had come to need and find in Milwaukee. Madison wealthy folk, probably sick to death of it, joined their money and built the Park Hotel. 118 sleeping rooms, including 12 with attached parlors. After all this fighting, would you believe the darn Capitol building burnt down? Well, 85% of it did anyway, in 1904. Some lousy watchman left the gas burner on in the cloakroom. The only rooms saved were the Attorney General's office, the Supreme Court office, and other offices towards North End, you know, by the post office. Thank goodness the city agreed to build another Capitol. 1907, the ground was broke. $7 million, and 10 years later, the most beautiful building you ever did see was completed. I'm not sure why they needed the New York, George B. Post and Sons firm to do the work, but I guess that's just my opinion. And anyway, it's been the same Capitol ever since. I've heard rumors now in 1997 that Madison is still having hotel problems. I hear, too, that Milwaukee is still trying to butt in. Maybe Madisonians will once again use property owners' money to settle the matter. I hear that's not so popular now. Well, I gotta go. If you want to chat again, I'll be here looking eastward with my sights set on the nation's capital. Yes, I'm at home on the dome. You can call me Wisconsin. This is Karen Schultz for the Writer's Place and Mind's Eye Radio.
In the early 1900s, the Lake Forest development was a vision of civic pride. This community project along Lake Wingra promised lots for thousands of homes, majestic parks, and stately boulevards. By the 1920s, dreams for the luxury neighborhood had sunk into the marsh. What went wrong? Linda Hart picks up the trail to Madison's Lost City.
Ken Wood has been giving public tours in UW-Madison's Arboretum for the last 8 years. On some tours, he finds ghosts of the past buried under the trails.
I don't know if you can see that. See, there is pavement there. We're walking on concrete still.
It's hard to believe when you're walking among the thicket of trees and shrubs here that underfoot lies the roads to a lost city.
Over the decades, the leaves have built up a litter and the honeysuckle and buckthorn have spread out on top of the pavement.
Crumbling roads and foundations are all that's left of what was to be a luxury neighborhood along the marshy shores of Lake Wingra. In the 1910s, planners envisioned a superb modern suburb with a grand circular mall, stately parks, and winding lagoons. Today, a mature forest buries the story of one of Madison's most spectacular development failures.
We'll go to the south here on a stretch that was actually built as a boulevard. Two portions were built here.
The Lake Forest development was the vision of Chandler B. Chapman, a Madison contractor. He saw the 800-acre site as an upscale neighborhood with a civic center, a sunken garden, and tree-lined streets. For only $10 down, families could buy a lot with a lakefront view.
They really did serious study of what the needs were, and this was one of the few areas relatively close to the city that hadn't been developed. And not only did they do that research, but the whole concept of the Lake Forest development was in many respects ahead of its time.
The developers promised trolley service, electricity, sewage, and more in what was considered Madison's first totally planned neighborhood. A circular mall with radiating streets and boulevards was to offer residents a spectacular view of the Capitol. But these promises never materialized. Almost as soon as the project got off the ground, it was plagued with problems, mainly with the land. The marshy surface required developers to lower the water table using two giant dredges that pumped out earth 12 hours a day. They also had to dig thousands of feet of canals to provide lakefront property. In the end, the soil, which was mainly peat and marl, wouldn't support the concrete roads. These structures quickly buckled and sank into the spongy soil.
It was tremendously ambitious, but it was very thoughtfully done in a way. I mean, it's hard to see for all the energy and thought that went into it. It's hard to see how they were so oblivious to the problem of the land.
Apart from land problems, financial setbacks, and waning enthusiasm finally sank the project for good. Only 61 lots were ever sold, and only 6 houses built. Trees and weedy shrubs quickly grew up around the half-finished roads. Today, only an experienced guide can find evidence that these houses ever existed.
This obviously was a stairway up to a porch, patio, whatever, and there are supports for the corners of, where did I see another big rock? Oh, it's right there. And there's the excavation for the basement area. If you wanted, you could get down in there and follow. There's rock work around the edge.
But the Lost City Forest also buries another past, a natural ecosystem called an oak savanna that existed throughout southern Wisconsin centuries ago. After the Lake Forest development became part of the Arboretum in the 1930s, the land sat unmanaged for nearly 60 years. Stately oaks, whose lower limbs have rotted from lack of sunlight, are now covered under thick layers of weedy shrubs and trees. Mark Leach, a UW ecologist, is helping to uncover this lost oak forest.
This area is dominated by large, old, over 100-year-old oak trees. It's a bit of a misnomer to call it a forest. At pre-settlement times, it would have been an oak savanna, and so a lot of these trees have grown up since then. Mostly when you look around here, you can't see very far into the woods because it's full of honeysuckle and buckthorn.
these non-native pests have invaded the Lost City, choking out native trees and grasses. Leach and his research team are studying ways to return this forest to its pre-settlement state by clearing trees, planting grass mixtures, and using fire.
Oaks are adapted to fire, and a lot of the invasive woody plants aren't. So we can use fire to keep the areas more open, which when these woodlands close in like this one has, the diversity of plants just goes down. There's very low diversity in here right now, and so one of the things we're trying to do is restore the natural diversity.
Leach hopes to bring hundreds of plant species back to this forest in the next several years. Many who've studied this forest say it's a premier place to understand oak restoration. It's also a link to a land with many past lives, as in oak woods and marsh when the Winnebago tribes lived here long ago, and as an idyllic city that was never to be.
If you notice, to your right, with the little trees and stuff are kind of curving off away from you. Well, that's the way the pavement goes.
From the Lost City Forest, I'm Linda Hart reporting.
In March 1933, all banks in Dane County closed for 14 days in response to a move by President Roosevelt to guarantee bank deposits and prevent a deepening national depression.
My name is Dorothy Littell Miller, and I was born and raised in Sauk City in 1904. And when we went to high school, it seems we always came over to a big city called Madison. Some people went up to Baraboo, but our family always seemed to travel to Madison. And I can remember that we always ate at Cops Cafe on the square. And then we went to the Orpheum to see vaudeville, and that was so prominent at that time. We saw Jack Benny and we saw Burns and Allen and all those famous people. We didn't know they were so famous then, of course.
I'm Stella Femright Sturba. My family lived out around Lake Monona on Monona Drive, and now one of the streets that goes off of Monona is called Femright Drive. And I do remember when Lindbergh made his flight to France, and when he made his tour then around the country. I was just a kid in grade school at the time, so. And he landed in an airfield that was out across from where, is that Southtown, I think they call it now. It's in that field that he landed. There was so much excitement that he was coming, and we were so anxious to see him. And we did actually see him because he did get out of the plane there. But then I know that he came into the city someplace to give a talk, but I don't remember where that was.
My name is Bill Gardner, and I'm talking about the early 30s when the milk farmers were having problems on their prices just as they are now. They tried many things, but they became so exasperated they finally agreed to all bring their milk into Madison and dump it on East Washington Avenue. Things got pretty rough. There was a lot of violence with it. In fact, the National Guard was called out. That's how I got to know something about it. I was in the National Guard Company at Platteville. I don't remember how many National Guard companies were brought up here to Madison at the time, and I don't remember how effective their strike was at that time.
My name is Ruth Moll. I came to Madison in 1936. My fond memories are the cabs that cruised around, especially down in the square. One could hail them and go to almost anywhere in the city limits for 15 cents. If you wanted to go out to Nakoma, it would be an extra 10 cents. Now, I don't know what we did about tipping. Probably nothing. A nickel tip would have been ostentatious, but it was wonderful while it lasted.
Okay, my name is Catherine DeBilzy. I met Freddie Mattioli, who started American TV. This must have been back in the 30s. He came to Madison. Madison had just got TV. Our first stations, the original stations, were operating here, and so the sale of TV receivings was very prosperous. And this company moved from one place to another where they were just starting up to get the cream off the crop. Ferdy came with them as a maintenance man. His home was in Chicago. He was an Italian and a very, very likable young man, and they had a very beautiful young wife, and they had one baby and another one on the way. So when this company left Madison, Ferdy decided that he was not going to keep moving with them because he wanted to have a family of kids. So he stayed in Madison and started selling TVs on his own and maintaining them himself. Once I saw him on the bus, and he said, "Have you seen today's paper?" And I said, "No." He said, "I've got an ad in there." And I looked at his little ad about 2 inches by 4 inches. American TV has page after page of ads today.
Before the turn of the century, the Capitol Square was lined with clapboard sidewalks frequently covered by wrangling settlers indulging in the services of brothels and saloons.
In 1956, after Sputnik, the University of Wisconsin at Madison was selected out of a field of 44 other universities to house the Mathematics Research Center, U.S. Army. The MRC was located in the center of campus in Sterling Hall on Charter Street, and was commissioned by the Army to conduct basic research. On Sunday, August 23, 1970, a bomb exploded in Sterling Hall, killing one and injuring five. The target of the bombing was the Math Research Center for its involvement with the Department of Defense during the Vietnam War. Commentator Fran Rawl witnessed the escalation of violence on campus toward the professors that worked at the center. One of them was her husband, Lewis.
"I have in my files a large yellow cardboard flyer with black letters an inch high, which reads, 'In opposing U.S. imperialism, SDS demands that the University of Wisconsin close down all ROTC program, Land Tenure Center, Army Math Center.' This was the first time I heard the center called the Army Center, but it was not to be the last. A facility working on basic mathematical research had become Army research, as though instant weapons would result. My husband, Dr. Lewis B. Rawl, was assistant director of the Mathematics Research Center, U.S. Army. In spite of the gradual escalation of radio attacks, letters to the editor, and general growth of alarm over the Vietnam War, none of us felt threatened at first. I thought it was a very good thing that evening TV showed casualties nearly every night. It brought home to the country how horrible war really is. Protests increased, and people marched on Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, the impression grew that the Madison campus harbored a major contributor to the carnage of soldiers and civilians alike. It began to seem impossible to try to explain what was actually being worked on at the center. Steve Claney, Dean of Letters and Science, published a 5-page position paper entitled A Dove's Defense of MRC. He stated that only around 4% of the work done at the Mathematics Research Center came under the range of classified research. Since the funding came from the Army, I doubt if his efforts changed some opinions. Others were probably glad to get some solid information about MRC from a reputable source. Max Gabler, minister of the Unitarian Church, spoke about opposition to Department of Defense funding for campus research. On his usual Friday morning WHA radio talk, he stated that we should accept funding from any U.S. government department or else refuse all. The MRC papers were published as MRC Technical Summary Reports, which stated on the cover that they were sponsored by the U.S. Army Research Office and available to the public. Bound copies can be found in many university libraries, but not in our memorial library. Someone considered them too dangerous to house there. As I look back on those terrible years, I run over in my mind what could have been done to prevent a terrible bombing that damaged Sterling Hall and blew out a huge part of Pharmacy, killing one man and gravely injuring another, plus destroying research and spreading shock across the country. Actually, the Math Research Center was not as damaged since it was higher from the ground. My only conclusion is that people who preach violence and advocate terrorism are very guilty. The weak people who are persuaded into the actual acts go to jail alone. I'm Fran Rawl for Mind's Eye Radio.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Coming of age in the summer of love at the University of Illinois, Gay Davidson Zilski protested, raised bail bonds, stormed police barricades, boycotted grapes, and depended on her town's underground newspaper as her only source of real news. 100 short miles away, but light years ahead in rabble-rousing Madison, Wisconsin, a spawning took place of not one, but a dozen alternate newspapers. Gay spoke with Phil Ball, a longtime political activist and aide to former Mayor Paul Soglin. Ball describes the scene that gave rise to the local underground press and its legacy. While Ball never actually wrote for the alternatives, he knew the players and the events that became the headlines.
There was a sense of history that was so strong because at that time on the University of Wisconsin campus, the feeling was the only way you're going to understand what's really going on in Vietnam is if you understand American history. And ultimately, you're going to have to be an amateur historian if you're going to get any peace of mind. And that was reflected in the underground papers at the time. It was reflected in journals.
In October of 1967, police violently attacked demonstrators sitting in to protest recruitment by Dow Chemical. This event set the stage for the next 3 years of demonstrations in which 30,000 people took part. And there arose simultaneously a need for trustworthy communications about these events. Madison's first underground, Connections, sprang up to fill this need.
What I saw when I came to Madison was the first few issues of Connections. I thought it was extremely boring. The grammar was always too correct. But it was really academically oriented, and it evolved to a paper called Kaleidoscope. And one of the people who left Connections and went to work for Kaleidoscope was Dave Wagner. And he had a fairly strong Marxist slant to bring about the kinds of changes that everyone thought were necessary. And that's the first issue of Kaleidoscope. It's sort of heavy on that kind of rhetoric. And it went down the tubes in part because of that. It lasted a little over 2 years, I believe, and evolved into two papers, essentially, one called King Street Trolley and Takeover, which was more anarchist in its tendencies.
In August of 1970, the center could no longer hold. Things flew apart, not the least of which was Sterling Hall. Michael Fellner, who carefully chronicled the proceeding of meetings and potential stories for Takeover, which today make up some 9 boxes in the State Historical Society archives, recalled that during this time, people didn't talk to each other. They wrote newspapers against each other. The Cap Times against the State Journal, the Daily Cardinal against the Badger Herald, and Takeover against Free For All. Phil Ball gives us his take on the life and death of Kaleidoscope.
And it was essentially a split between two people, Dave Wagner and Mark Knops. Mark Knops essentially started Kaleidoscope as it evolved away from Wagner. In the fall of 1970, when Knops was arrested for refusing to tell a grand jury what he knew about the firebombing of Old Main on the Whitewater campus. And his defense was these were the sources that a journalist had, that was a journalist's stock and trade, and that he was not required to reveal the names of his sources. And even if he was, he wouldn't do it. And what he expected, extremely naively, was the journalistic community of the country to come to his defense because he was defending principles that all journalists live by. You simply cannot reveal the names of your sources, the identity of your sources. Well, the journalistic community said to Mark Knapps, "Mark who?" Yeah. Kaleidoscope went on for a while, and there was a real bitter dispute within Kaleidoscope. Finally, there was kind of an irrevocable split that led to takeover. That's what the name comes from. They took over, and then takeover pretty much had the field until its demise in 1980 or 1981.
Yeah. I'm sitting here holding what appears to be an issue of the Capital Times, Friday, July 13th, 1973, and the headline is in banner type, "Nixon Suicide Attempt Fails." Subheading is, "Nixon Note Says, I Want to Join Checkers." In tiny type, off to the far right, is this statement, "Takeover Edition." Tell us what the scene was like the day this hit the stands.
Well, it was interesting, to say the least. The context is this. Nixon is under huge pressure because of Watergate. When the paper comes out with the exact typeset as the Cap Times, the same layout, and it's put in the boxes on the square where the Cap Times was sold and all the old Cap Times were tossed out, takeover was put in, people would walk by, and they would practically have a heart attack when they saw this. And you could see some people's faces light up in huge grins, I mean, as they read this, and others started to cry. There was a real scene on the square. Miles McMillan, who was the publisher of the Cap Times, this morning he came down Carroll Street with his one-star edition of the Cap Times, headed down to the Badger Candy Kitchen, looked in the Cap Times box, and saw his own paper with the headline, "Nixon Suicide Attempt Fails." And he thinks it's a real issue that his own paper put out. He doesn't realize that it's a false issue.
Oh, no.
And then someone points out to him that it's a takeover issue, and he calls the cops and he wants all the issues confiscated. He wants the hawkers shot. It was so close to the truth. Even if it wasn't true, it should have been true.
Even deeper underground, sprinkled throughout, there were always short-lived but idealistic papers. Going by whimsical names such as Underground Underdog, Psst, Oscar's Underground Ghetto Press, and Bad Moon Rising, they culminated in The Phoenix, The Insurgent, and The Edge. The alternative press was with us all the way up until 1990, but still, there was a sense that there was no more turning back to the heyday of the underground than there was to the events that spawned these manifestos of the 60s and 70s.
There are two underground newspapers in the history, the modern history of Madison. One is Takeover, and the second is All the Others. In part because Takeover was around for so long. In truth, the people were so talented, so committed, and had an unbelievable amount of nerve. Most of the others were started without the slightest idea of just how much time and energy it takes to put out even a rag of a newspaper on a regular basis. I mean, it is all-consuming. So they came and they went, and they're forgotten.
Why can't it happen now? Why don't undergrounds happen now?
I guess I would give you the answer that I would have given you then and that they would give you, because of you. You're not doing it, and you're waiting for someone else to do it.
This is Gay Davidson-Zelsky reminiscing with Phil Ball, former mayoral aide and political activist, who is now philosophizing and helping to run the Cafe Carp in Fort Atkinson, where we spoke together.
In 1996, Madison and Dane County made history by electing two women to prominent political positions, Kathleen Falk as county executive and Sue Bauman as mayor of Madison. Remember the local newspaper headline, "Dame County"? Writer Luis Mancuso spoke with Mayor Bauman on her vision for Madison and Dane County.
Obviously, as the first woman elected to be mayor of the city of Madison, I'm very proud of the fact that finally, after many, many years, the city of Madison did elect a woman to be